The Homeless Podcast deals with topics of a sensitive nature and is not intended for all audiences. At times, this podcast may include explicit language or adult themes. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to the Homeless Podcast, Season 1, Episode 14, a podcast that tells the stories of those that live on the fringe of society and those that seek to help. If you haven't already subscribed, please make sure you do so on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you may be listening right now. As you listen to this episode, please note that the opinions stated on the podcast by guests do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the Homeless Podcast itself. I'm going to get a little bit personal on this episode. I strive to be open-minded and a listener to all points of view. But there's too much damned hate in the world. So here we are. A rising second wave of a pandemic. People assigning the health and safety of mask wearing to political preferences. People ignoring over 400 years of proven, systematic racism. Anger over posts on social media because they don't fit a certain narrative. Believing our own narratives are the most important opinions out there. I've heard it from strangers, I've heard it from friends, and it's caused me to really dive into what I believe is right and good while trying to listen to all perspectives. And as hard as it is, I want to encourage you to think about this, changing your mind, allowing a new perspective to take hold, and considering different points of view. That doesn't show weakness, it shows growth. You know what does show weakness? Closing your ears and eyes without thinking about the possibility that maybe, just maybe, there might be an opportunity for you to grow. I was recently in a town meeting, online of course, where the topic of discussion was racism and homelessness. Systematic racism is one of the major causes of homelessness, if not the main cause. The two are intertwined. People of color are not given the same opportunities, the same healthcare advantages, the same educational access, even the same access to get a mortgage. Now, before I continue, I want you to think about something. Really think about it. Is what I'm saying causing you to agree, to disagree, or to just get annoyed? After all, who am I to say anything like this? Think about your response. Think about why you are having that response. Inside the fire, waiting for the time of love, waiting for the truth you said was. Think about your environment. Where you come from, where you are going, and what you've been through, what you've been forced to believe. Don't shy away, dig, and don't stop digging. You may find out that you have some room to grow. You may find that you are exactly where you need to be. Look around at all the poison in the world, at all the hate. Are we not better than this? I think we are. And yet, as all of this poison comes to the surface for many of us, because, let's face it, so many have seen it already for so long, their entire lives, in fact. Maybe this is humanity exposing the poison, the infection. It's ugly, it's gross, and it downright stinks. But maybe we are going to heal after this. Then again, maybe not. I want to tell you a story that a dear friend sent to me, which recently took place in Orange County, California. It's about as dark as we can get, but it needs to be told, because we can fight this. Meet William, a 38-year-old man who decided to walk along the streets of Los Angeles and try an experiment. William thought it would be interesting to lace food with oleoresin capsicum, a substance that is twice as strong as the pepper spray we see police currently using during the thousands of riots taking place across the nation. William set out with a camera, some plated-up meals laced with this poison, and a goal to see what would happen to someone if they ate said meal. He recruited a miner to help him with this little project, set up his tripod, and went to work. William found vulnerable individuals that were dealing with homelessness and kindly offered them a meal.
Here, have some food. I think you'll really enjoy it, and I'd like to video you as you eat it. I bet you won't believe the amazing flavor. Enjoy.
William began to film. He saw the individuals convulse, vomit, bleed from the nose, have severe stomach and throat pains, go into shock, and have seizures. Now, I'm no psychologist, but I can guess that his intent was to exploit these people by filming them, so he could go back and watch it as some form of entertainment later. Most of William's victims were not aware it was poisoned, and were given beer and other food to entice them. If you haven't eaten for a while, you can imagine the temptation to gratefully accept a free meal. On May 22nd of this year, in Huntington Beach, William was finally arrested. He was charged with 8 counts of poisoning and 1 count of inflicting injury on an elderly person, all felonies. He was also charged with 8 misdemeanor counts of contributing to the delinquency of a minor and an infraction of consuming alcohol or smoking marijuana while driving. William is being held in the Orange County Jail on a $500,000 bail and faces up to 19 years behind bars. We may never know the reason he did this, but I tend to think that he saw these individuals as disposable, as expendable. I'm sickened by this. I truly hope that William earns the maximum sentence, and if he doesn't, the public deserves to know why. William represents pure hatred and disregard for humanity. But there is good in this world. There is beauty, there is peace, and there is love. I want to introduce you to someone who has created jobs for those that are facing homelessness, and he sees every individual as a non-expendable part of society. As the founding director of the Real Change newspaper in Seattle, Washington, he has created purpose and drive for those he employs, and offers real change by embracing his organization's 5 values, courage, community, creativity, compassion, and integrity. Founded in 1994 to offer immediate employment options for those that are dealing with homelessness and challenging the structures that create poverty, Real Change serves their vendors through a vendor program that requires no ID and meets the vendors where they are at in life. Real Change also holds advanced sales training, vendor leadership positions, paid participation in the Homeless Speakers Bureau, and many other opportunities to enrich job skills and development. It was truly an honor to talk with him, and I can't wait for you to hear what he has to say, his story, and why he does what he does. This is Real Change. This is Tim. Hey, Tim, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay, is it better?
Yeah, I'm doing this from my laptop instead of my phone.
You sound great. You sound really good here.
Good. How are you sounding? Are you getting feedback from me?
Nope, you sound like you're sitting in the room with me. I've been wanting to try this new software. So you get you get to be my guy. I'm so sorry about that.
Okay, that's fine.
Than what I normally do. Yeah. So how are you? Thanks again for putting up with that.
No problem.
It's the world of Zoom, isn't it? I got 6 hours of Zoom a day and my head is just fuzz right now. Just bullshit technology everywhere.
going to get much more sick of this before it's all over.
I remember walking down the streets to the Kingdom, going to the very last game of the Seahawks. It was Dan Marino's last game. And I sat on the end zone. And I remember walking in the streets, getting up to the Kingdom and getting a newspaper from somebody on the side of the street. And it was obviously somebody who looked a little, I assumed they were homeless at the time. And this is back in to early 2000s. I think it was 99. I can't remember when that last game was. But I remember that really stuck with me. And I wondered, what is this about? And I read through that paper and it just felt like a great normal newspaper to me, but with really interesting stories. So I just want to let you know, that's kind of, that was my first experience with real change. And that was what, you know, 20 years ago or so, which is kind of cool. So tell me about you a little bit.
Well, you know, my work doing this goes back for a while. I've been working, organizing homeless folks and or doing alternative press for probably the last 35 years. I was a teenage runaway. I think that that's part of how my interest in homelessness started. And there were some pretty lean survival years that came along with that, that really helped me to identify with what people on the street are going through and the kinds of things that set people up in life for rough times later. You know, I've always had this awareness that it's really, you know, some just good fortune that separates me from the folks that I work with that are homeless. Started my first newspaper when I was at UMass Amherst. It was a monthly anarchist paper called Critical Times. I graduated and I moved to Boston and I started organizing homeless folks. I basically majored in student radicalism when I was
in college.
That's awesome.
I like that. Student radicalism. That's great.
Yeah, I was a social thought and political economy major. One of the actions that I went to was probably in like 1985. We went to Washington, D.C. and got arrested to support Mitch Snyder, who was doing a long fast. It was, I think, 52 days that he was fasting to get support for a large homeless shelter in Washington, D.C. The Center for Creative Nonviolence was opening their shelter in D.C. And he almost died from that fast. And that was my first involvement with the issue of homelessness, and I kind of got hooked, and I moved to Boston and started organizing homeless people. And I'd been organizing homeless people for a few years, and I became more and more aware of this contradiction that I was facing as an organizer, which is that the horizon for economic justice organizing is very long and uncertain. And the people that I was organizing, their needs were very dire and immediate. And I was having a hard time reconciling that because, you know, I could convince people to come be part of a sit-in at the state house or do a tent city at the federal building, but the odds of them benefiting from that directly were slim to none. And I was having trouble with that and wanted to figure out a style of organizing that not only built homeless leadership, but delivered something more tangible and immediate to the people directly involved. So in the early 80s, Street News started publishing in New York. That's widely regarded as the seminal paper in the modern street paper movement. And I was looking at that and thinking, you know, this is my answer. I'd been involved in several small press volunteer-based publications as editor or publisher, and I knew how to do that. And I'd been organizing homeless people, so I had, you know, both skill sets that I needed to do a homeless newspaper. So I started a paper called Spare Change in Boston in 1992. That paper is still running. I started that as a homeless run newspaper, a strictly homeless run newspaper. I was kind of in my radical Alinskyist organizer period at that point, and saw my role as an organizer, not to make decisions, but to facilitate the people directly involved making the decisions in the project. So it was totally run by homeless people.
That's amazing.
And that turned out, yeah, it was amazing, but it was also really unstable.
Sure, sure, sure. Yeah, of course.
To, you know, in terms of what I wanted to do, which was to, you know, build a poor people's institution that would grow and deliver power to people who are low income and homeless. It was a troublesome project. There was a lot of internal conflict, and it was just difficult. And they also wanted to be completely independent from the sponsoring organization, which was Boston Jobs with Peace. They wanted to be their own paper. So, you know, I organized to help them get their nonprofit status and become independent, and then went about the business for myself of figuring out how to do another paper that was built to last. So I basically decided that for this to be viable, I needed a cross-class organizing model that not only involved homeless people, but brought in other folks as well. Everybody bringing their skills to the table and participating in ways that made sense for them. And I moved to Seattle to start another paper in 1994. And that's when I started Real Change in Seattle. And now it's been 26 years. And we're a weekly paper that has about 300 vendors every month that are selling it.
Yeah, so, quite a story. Yeah, no, absolutely. So what brought you to Seattle?
It was, you know, one of those things is kind of a combination of personal accident and and city that really met what I was looking for. You know, we have been here visiting some relatives, and I was looking to move to a new city, and there was a robust homeless organizing culture in Seattle already. Operation Homestead was doing housing takeovers with homeless people. There was a Street Life art gallery that was run by the artists themselves, homeless people producing and selling their art. Share was an organization that was doing homeless survival-based tent cities that were self-run by homeless people. So I was very attracted to all of that. And it also just felt like, you know, a liberal, affluent city where a street paper would be embraced by people and would be able to succeed. And that turned out to be really true.
Well, and you know, the whole area, and that was when I just started college, and my undergrad was those years. And during those times, I remember Pumpin' Nirvana, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, all those awesome bands where we were kind of the center. And it was interesting how that music actually felt so cultural and kind of went along with the cultural movements that I noticed in Seattle during that time. Like, you know what I mean?
See, yeah, I do know what you mean. And Seattle has changed a lot since then. And I would not say it's been for the better.
That's true. We are seeing, especially this homeless community. I mean, we are seeing this just kind of explode more and more.
Crazy. It's crazy. And, you know, I mean, we've always had unsheltered homelessness in Seattle. When I moved here from Boston, it was kind of a shock to me because mm-hmm. Boston has a right to shelter law. Like New York has a right to shelter law. So what they do is they peg the amount of available shelter to their annual count. And if they have significant numbers of unsheltered people on the street, they increase the supply of emergency shelter to meet that demand. And, you know, I thought that that was normal. I thought that every place did things like that, that that having people unsheltered and on the street without access to even emergency shelter was not something that, you know, civilized society did. And then I moved to Seattle and I found that there was roughly a 2-to-1 ratio of sheltered to unsheltered people. So, you know, back in 95 when I was starting the paper, I mean, we were doing a one-night count annually, a point-in-time count, even back then. Seattle was one of the first cities in the nation to do that, and we kind of pioneered that. So back then, there were something like 3,500 homeless people altogether in King County, and about 1,000 of those were unsheltered. And I thought that was barbaric. I thought that was just horrible that, you know, this county would allow 1,000 people to be unsheltered. And here we are 25 years later, and we have like 12,000 homeless people on a single night, and about 5,000 of those being unsheltered. So, you know, the problem has become dramatically worse over the last few decades, and people have kind of accommodated to it, which is very disturbing. We kind of keep reaching new lows and the new normal and what people will tolerate.
You know, you talk about 5,000 people every night that are unsheltered, and I've been talking to a couple of other shelters, and I know that it really is coming down to resources and digging for resources. And where do you get those resources? Through sponsorship. And that leads me to ask how your paper, how Real Change is actually funded. Where do you get most of your funding from?
Well, we have an annual budget. You know, we've grown into a pretty good sized organization. So we have an annual budget of about $1.4 million, and we actually have 16 staff people. We have an advocacy department, we have the vendor program that, you know, manages and supports those 300 vendors a month that are selling the newspaper. And we also have a professional news team of 4 staff people that produce the weekly paper and, you know, the administrative staff that an organization needs. We have a co-director structure and, you know, a fundraiser and you know, various administrative support staff. So we raise about $1.4 million a year to support all that. And 60% of it roughly comes through individual donations.
Wow.
There's about 2,000 people every year that write checks to support our work. And we have always had that level of deep grassroots community support. And it's really been the secret to our success and enabled us to do uncompromising advocacy and journalism, because, you know, we're not dependent on city funding or advertisers and that sort of thing for our funding. We're completely uncompromised by our funding sources. So beyond the individual donations, about 25% of our income comes from circulation of the newspaper. The vendors sell the paper for $2 cover price plus tips on the street. So, you know, that comes to, I don't know, probably $25,000 a month in circulation revenue that helps to support the paper. And then the rest of it is largely foundation support, ranging from, you know, a large grant that we have to for our organizing that's like $75,000 a year, down to, you know, smaller family foundations and that sort of thing that, you know, are giving us $2,000 to $3,000 a year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, our funding is this three-legged stool of individual support, circulation, and foundations. And it has been very stable over the years and allowed us to grow and thrive.
We'll be right back. In the mid-80s, I would often help my big brother out on his paper route. Everyone received the journal, as we used to affectionately call it. I would follow my big brother, and he would load up his orange 10-speed Schwinn with plastic wrap to keep the papers dry, and off we'd go. Later on in life, I would peruse the sports section and the politics sections to prepare for the upcoming debates that seemed to happen in my high school civics class every day. The sports section was just to see how my beloved University of Washington Huskies were performing. The paper meant something to me. And sadly, we are seeing the end of that medium. Less and less people are subscribing to papers. Papers are delivered by the post rather than the kids who want to earn a buck. And yet, real change news survives. And it thrives. This paper is run by a team that seeks to help those living without shelter and offers them dignity and respect by paying a high commission on papers sold. Their intent is not just to sell paper, it's to change lives. Real Change offers mentor programs, vendor leadership opportunities, and exposure to articles and news that mainstream media either skips over, bends to meet an agenda, or honestly, just doesn't care. A nonprofit organization based in Seattle, Real Change is making an impact with up to 3,000 paid vendors per month. Think about that. 3,000 per month. Individuals who want to earn their keep, learn a trade, and spread joy. I have to say, this is just awesome. You can learn more about Real Change at realchangenews.org. Click on the big blue donate button and support these amazing efforts to provide work experience to those who seek it. Your donation, no matter how big or small, helps to change lives, change perspectives, and change hearts. Now that is real change. realchangenews.org. Seattle's award-winning street newspaper. Immediate economic opportunity for people who are low income and homeless.
All right. So tell me about the vendors that are employed by Real News or Real Change News and where they come from, what their stories may be. I know they're probably varied and how that goes about.
Yeah, well, you're right. Our vendors are kind of all over the place with their stories. Everybody has a different story. And it's changed a bit over the years. You know, now about half of our vendors are actually housed. And typically that looks like somebody who is older and on a limited fixed income, probably like a, you know, Social Security disability check that they get. So, you know, they get like $750 a month in disability, and they're in either public or nonprofit housing and paying a third of their income for their rent, which, you know, leaves them the princely sum of about $500 a month to meet all of their other life expenses. So, you know, they're usually formerly homeless people, and they sell the paper to, you know, make that reasonable. to be able to live on, you know, the money that they have plus their income for the newspaper.
Sure.
So that's a number of our vendors, probably a little bit less than half of them. Of our vendors who are homeless, some of them stay in shelter, some of them stay in either one of the sanctioned encampments in Seattle that are run by the residents, or in one of the tiny house villages. Mm-hmm. And we also have people who are unsheltered and are sleeping out. You know, a lot of our vendors are very independent, and for a variety of reasons, emergency shelter solutions in Seattle don't work for them. And they're either camping out or sleeping in their cars or something like that. You know, real change is all about meeting people where they're at and being there as an alternative for folks to earn an income that works with their situation. And we have vendors who are selling, you know, 20 to 50 papers a month and doing it pretty casually. And we have vendors who are treating it like a full-time job and selling more like 1,000 papers a month. Mm. And, you know, are paying for market rent with what they earn from the paper and staying housed that way. So it's kind of all over the place. The majority of our vendors, something like 75% of them, self-identify as having some form of disability, either physical or emotional, that prevents them from being able to hold full-time work. So the flexibility of real change, where you can go out and sell the paper when and where it works for you, set your own hours, that sort of thing. Really, that flexibility really works for people in meeting them where they're at and allowing them to do it in a way that meets their needs.
Mm. Have you had any individual stories that kind of stick out to your mind of, you know, where somebody was at and when they found you and how their life journey kind of changed, I guess?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got a million of those
stories. I figure you had 26 years just in Seattle alone. I bet. Is there one that sticks out to you that's interesting?
Well, you know, one of my favorite stories is one of my oldest stories, and that was a guy in the early days of the paper that really shifted my understanding of what we were doing and what it was all about. And his name was Richard. And he was a heroin addict when he started selling the paper. And he, you know, was – his life was very challenging. And like a lot of people who are homeless, his self-esteem had just been beat to shit. Mm. And he – you know, did not have a very exalted opinion of humanity in general. You know, people had not been good to him mm-hmm. throughout his life. And he, you know, just really didn't like people very much. And Richard also had this sort of a profound stutter. You know, he was a guy who, you know, you would talk to him and he would be kind of looking at his feet, and he had a fairly profound stutter, and it was tough for him to communicate. And you know, his low self-esteem was pretty obvious when you talked to him. So he had been selling the paper for about 2 years when we decided that he was going to be our vendor of the month, and I interviewed him for the vendor of the month story. And by then he had gotten clean. He had stopped with the heroin and had gotten on methadone and was in the process of overcoming that addiction. And, you know, when I was interviewing him, he told me that that he used to hate people, but that selling the paper and that the support that he got from his readers and all of the conversations that he would have while he was out selling the paper, where people genuinely cared for him and would ask after his welfare and would like bring him Christmas presents and remember his birthday and things like that, not only shifted Richard's notion of what people were about and allowed him to begin to open up and trust again, but it really shifted his notion of what he was about and what he was capable of personally. And this was what led him to embrace sobriety and walk away from the heroin addiction and start to deal with that. And the really striking thing about Richard was the way he presented, how he presented to the world shifted dramatically. Instead of like mumbling and looking down at his feet when he would talk to you, he would look you in the eye and he carried himself straighter. And most amazingly, his stutter like virtually went completely away. You know, he overcame that because of the self-confidence that he was able to gain and the self-esteem that he was able to gain through selling the paper. And up until that point, if you had asked me what Real Change was about fundamentally, I would have said we are a flexible employment project that meets people where they're at, and we're a platform for doing organizing on behalf of homeless and low-income people. But what I realized was that beyond all of that, what we were most fundamentally about was creating relationships on the street that are sustaining to people, that shift not only public perceptions of who homeless people are and defy all of those stereotypes that people kind of carry around in their head that present barriers to empathy, to people being really able to understand that homeless people are really no different than anybody else. And homeless people understanding that they do matter, that there are people who care about them, that will treat them with dignity, approach them as just another, a sort of fellow human who deserves empathy. And, you know, treat them like a person. And that experience of not being treated like you're invisible, being treated like a person, shifts people's idea of who they are in the world and what they can accomplish. And what I've seen over and over again is, you know, people who come to us who are struggling with various addictions, they start selling the paper at first as a means to feed that addiction. But then when they experience the caring community of the Real Change readership and people treating them like a person, their notion of who they are begins to shift. And it very often leads them to this point where their notion of who they are now doesn't square with past dysfunctional behaviors. And they're able to put down the heroin or the alcoholism or, you know, the meth or the crack or whatever it was that was holding them back, just because they decide that that's not who they are anymore.
Yeah.
And And to me, that's the most profound thing about what we do. And really the magic of real change is just how powerful that experience of community is for people.
Do you, you know, I was looking at your website and I've been kind of looking at it a lot lately and I just love it. I've been actually looking at some of the articles. And one of the things that stands out to me is that you stand for economic, social, and radical justice. And I love that. I think that's a profound statement because it's pretty much in your face what we're going to stand for. Right. And I love that. It kind of takes it back to your beginnings with your college major of what do you call it? Student radicalism. Right. Yeah. Tell me about that. Tell me about the three piers that you've set up there, the economic, social, and radical justice, and how you approach that in your stories.
Racial justice. It's, I mean, our mission is to provide opportunity and a voice to homeless and low-income people while taking action for economic, social, and racial justice. So what that is about, I mean, our mission is also a three-legged stool. There's the opportunity that the newspaper provides. That's kind of the economic dimension of it that directly benefits the vendors. There's the creating a voice for homeless and low-income people dimension of it, you know, empowering people through our speakers bureau, through our organizing, through our newspaper to be able to tell their stories and have an impact on public policy. And the taking action for economic, social, and racial justice, you know, which really goes to how homelessness is not about individual failures and you know, the sort of problems that individual people have, but it is about a structural abandonment of poor people, working class people, people of color, and how that has led to a very unequal and racist society, and that we have to confront that structurally through our organizing if we hope to change anything. You know, I mean, things like, I mean, charity can only mitigate homelessness. Mm-hmm. You need to organize for justice to really get at the issue at the roots. And that's what real change is about.
How do you approach that when you say justice and finding justice? Because what I'm hearing is that you, as a person too, and I know it's the mission of also Real Change, but is to, I don't like to use the term cash in hand, but it's to show immediately upfront, here is how you're going to benefit right away, rather than sitting around waiting. You know, there's some people out there, they have to wait for Section 8, they wait 4 or 5 years to get housing vouchers and that kind of thing. And you are making an immediate impact where they see the effects immediately. Is that kind of in line with what you're trying to do here?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the parallels that I like to make occasionally is to what the Black Panther Party did in the day, you know, where they had a political program. And that was, you know, obviously a very important part of what they did. They had, you know, radical politics and a way of viewing society that was very critical and a whole sort of, you know, political ideology that was part of their work. But they also did the Freedom Schools, they did the meals programs in the neighborhoods. They did very, very practical things that benefited people immediately. And, you know, we've seen the efforts of government to address homelessness have been, you know, very disappointing overall. In the time I've been doing Real Change, we've seen homeless in Seattle probably quadruple, you know, and that's a pretty dismal track record. A lot of people doing really great work, but when you don't address that structural inequality that underlies all of it and is the driver of homelessness, you get mitigation that doesn't really do anything to solve the fundamental problem.
Right.
What we can do in the face of that is offer people on an individual basis direct opportunities for to basically take things into their own hands. We offer people an opportunity to earn an income, to change their own individual situation. And we also support various efforts for homeless people to provide their own shelter solutions. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the things that's unique about Seattle is that there is a really thriving culture of self-managed homeless encampments and tiny house villages that are really addressing the failure of the institutional shelter system to meet the needs of homeless people by, through organizing and self-management, kind of taking the issue into their own hands and providing their own solutions. Another example of that, right now we're, of course, dealing with the COVID-19 outbreak and how that's impacting homeless people. Mm. And we've been pushing the city to offer various hygiene solutions to homeless folks to help contain the spread of the disease among the homeless population. And one of the things that we've been pushing for is hand washing stations around the city so that people who are on the street are able to maintain that basic level of personal hygiene. And only about a half dozen hand washing stations have been created around the city, which, falls far short of the need. So we worked with a group of architects and college professors from the University of Washington to develop a hand washing station that can be put together with about $350 worth of items from Home Depot and hook up to a garden hose, and have started making those available to places around the city that want to host a hand washing station.
Wow. That is cool.
While when the city does this, it takes them tens of thousands of dollars and all of this bureaucracy to be able to put one of these things mm-hmm. up. And, we're able to do it on a shoestring and make it immediately available to people.
That's amazing. Have you come into issues with public land or permits or that kind of thing, placing these hand washing stations around?
Well, we just placed the first one of them earlier this week.
Okay.
And it was at the Roots Homeless Shelter on their property.
Oh, okay.
And we're reaching out to other organizations and churches and businesses to find other people that want to place this on their property.
That's amazing. Let me just think about this for a second with you. If somebody wanted to, say, sponsor a hand washing station, which sounds kind of like an intriguing idea, was that something that uh-huh. would be of interest to your organization or the people you're working with as well?
That's exactly what we're working toward. Is, being able to bring this to scale, because we know that there's public support for this sort of
thing. That is excellent. It's been really enlightening, by the way. One more question for you. How can I help? How can anybody that wants to help and reach out to you be a part of real change and make a difference? What are your needs?
Sure. Well, I mean, there are, of course, multiple answers to that question. It begins with just recognizing homeless folks on the street and treating them like people. We hear over and over and over again, the hardest thing about being homeless is that people just look right through you like you're invisible. People are disturbed by homelessness. It's depressing. And the way a lot of folks deal with that is to just kind of shut down and ignore it. And that is really, really hard for folks who are homeless, because it not only says we don't care, it also says you don't even exist. So just the simple act of looking somebody in the eye and asking them how they are, and having a conversation is important. And, you know, real change creates opportunities for people to do that in a way that feels comfortable for folks. So supporting our vendors on the street when you see them, but also just more generally recognizing the humanity of homeless folks. Getting involved in the issue by volunteering, helping with, I mean, there's a million organizations out there that are working with homeless folks that are looking for volunteers and opportunities to get directly involved. We have found over and over again that the one thing that shifts people's perceptions of homelessness and homeless people most is proximity to homeless people and the issue. When you get directly engaged and you start working with homeless people, you really understand that homeless folks are like everybody else. And that is kind of a radicalizing realization. You're no longer able to dismiss homelessness as being the product of individual failure. But, you know, you begin to understand it as an issue of systemic abandonment of poor people. And, you know, the solution to that is people getting involved and taking responsibility for how this plays out in our society. And then finally, taking political action. You know, I mean, we desperately need more permanent supportive housing for homeless people. Our housing market will never be able to address homelessness. Housing is produced for profit, not to meet a human need. And it will always fail our social needs for housing. So we need to create alternatives for that. In Seattle, there is a desperate need. Well, in King County, there is a need for approximately 6,500 additional units of permanent supportive housing. That's what it's going to take to bring homelessness. I mean, we'll never eliminate homelessness, but to make it rare, brief, one time. That's kind of the mantra. Mm-hmm. The answer to that is housing, and we all have to work together for that. But also, you know, in addition to the housing, we have to look at what we do to mitigate the issue in the meanwhile. And that means supporting the civil rights of homeless people and being involved in that kind of organizing, supporting additional emergency shelter for homeless people, and supporting new creative opportunities for housing homeless people, or at least giving alternatives to being unsheltered and on the street, like sanctioned encampments that are self-managed and tiny house villages that allow people to live in dignity and in community rather than be socially isolated and vulnerable.
Tim, I want to thank you so much. If listeners want to hear from you directly, I know they can go to realchangenews.org and click on your profile and read the Director's Corner. There's some great articles in there I've found, especially the one that you wrote 2 days ago called We're All in This Together. Because as I mean, the vendors aren't out there. You know, they're not making the same money. So I appreciate that article. And it says, you know, what we need now is food distribution, hygiene products, gift and cash cards. And I think that's something that even as we're in this crazy pandemic time, that everybody can get involved and give that way. And that's been really good for me to read personally, because I think, you know, how can I do it? What can I do to be involved? And I think, well, like you've said, and you've hit on this a number of times, making it personal, not just with how you can help, but also making it personal when you look at someone and not look through them. And I hear this every single time I talk to someone, treat people like people. You know, we're all, everybody's one crisis away from homelessness, almost everybody, you know, and that's a sobering fact.
Right. I mean, you know, the mantra for our new COVID-19 era is that we are all in this together. Mm-hmm. And when we look at the crisis of homelessness and how homeless people have been impacted by this, it is tremendously important that we include homeless folks as part of the solution and prioritize meeting their needs, because there is a real danger that homelessness is going to increase as a result of the economic disruption of this. But that we will accommodate ourselves to increasingly unacceptable forms of homelessness and the vulnerabilities that go along with that. We're really at kind of a crossroads in our society where we either take care of everybody and alter the relationships that we have to be able to do that, or we abandon people, and in the course of that, abandon ourselves. We really are all in it together, and that starts with helping the people who are most vulnerable.
Absolutely.
First.
I'd love to say that you're a radical, Tim, but I don't think you're radical. I think you're a humanitarian. Tim, thanks again for being with us. And if people want to learn about the paper more, or they want to learn about your cause, they can go to realchangenews.org. There are so many resources on there, and I love it. I've really enjoyed following you on Facebook as well. So thanks again, Tim.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Real Change News, meeting people where they are at, providing jobs to those that might not be able to hold down a traditional job, flexibility to meet individual needs, embracing sobriety with a purpose. Real Change News does so much to help so many. Think about the story of Richard that Tim shared. By providing self-confidence and self-esteem through selling a paper, Richard changed his life. Tim's ultimate goal is to shift the public perception of those living in homelessness and with addictions. He provides a caring community, and the hold on past dysfunctional behaviors disappears. The power of community is a power that will change this world, social and radical justice. Homelessness is not about individual failures. It is about a structural abandonment. An unequal and racist society must be confronted head-on if we hope to change. Justice is key. Justice is the goal. Justice is real change. Tim is a humanitarian. His mission is to make immediate change. He has created opportunities to provide immediate development for those seeking help. He strives to offer direct opportunities to individuals to take things into their own hands. Please visit Real Change News online and donate to the amazing organization, realchangenews.org. Real change is radical change. Real change is justice for all. My special thanks to Moby, the world-renowned recording artist, DJ, and philanthropist. The Homeless Podcast is proud to share his song, Welcome to Hard Times, in this episode that you heard at the beginning, and is shared here courtesy of MobyGratis.com. Check out the links in the episode to hear Moby on various platforms. And while you're at it, please feel free to leave a review about the Homeless Podcast and contact us if you have any suggestions and close ones that might want to tell their story. You can reach us by email at homelesspodcast@yahoo.com. And don't forget to visit our new website, www.homelesspnw.com. That's homelesspnw.com. Season 1 is about to wrap up, and I have to say, it's been quite a journey for me. The more I learn about homelessness, the more I learn just how much I don't really know. I hope this journey has been one for you as well. One of growth, one of insight, and one of compassion. See you in 2 weeks, and until then, don't look away.